today is the first day of Hanukkah, but it's also Erev Nittelnacht. Nittelnacht is the Jewish word for Christmas Eve. I prepared a shiur a few years ago for my daughter. Why did I prepare a shiur for my daughter? She was part of a youth group here in Israel, and some of the kids, the Israeli kids, the native Israeli kids, had this idea that one Friday night at the weekly get-together, they would do some sort of Secret Santa. And some of the boys in this group that had grown up in the United States were kind of horrified by this. Like, we're Jewish, we don't celebrate Christmas. And so I heard my daughter discussing this with friends, and she brought it up with us, you know, because it was quite the dilemma. And I said, how about this? I'll come and I'll give a talk, I'll give a shiur to your group about how Jews celebrate Christmas. Now, I know what you're thinking. Jews celebrate Christmas by eating Chinese food. Jews celebrate Christmas by going to the movies. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean that for hundreds, possibly thousands of years, well, not thousands, but almost 2,000 years, Jews have been marking Christmas on the calendar with certain observances. Now, Christmas is not a Jewish holiday. If Christmas was a Jewish holiday, you'd have all kinds of other laws, or you'd have refinements of existing customs. For example, you would have long discussions about specifically what types of species of evergreen are acceptable for use as a Christmas tree. Can it be a spruce? Does it have to be a pine? Can it be a fir? If you say that it could be a fir, can it be any fir? Just a Douglas fir? These are the kinds of questions that you would have. You would have questions for those who are more in tune with these things. You would have a question of whether if Santa brings you fruits and vegetables, would you have to tithe it? Would you have to take trumot and masrot? Why? Because normally you only have to take tithes on things that come into the house in the normal way, through the front door. So if something comes in through the chimney, normally we say that you don't have to tithe it. You don't have to take trumot and maasrot. But if it's the normal way for Santa to bring food through the chimney, is that considered the normal way just because it's normal for Santa? Or do we say that since it's not the normal way of bringing food into the house, it's exempt from tithes? And you would have discussions of, you know, how tall does one, or short does one have to be in order to qualify as an elf? 10 tefachim, 15 tefachim. These are the kinds of questions that you would have. There's, if you look on the hashtag on Twitter, Hilchos Christmas, a few years ago, there was a phenomenal discussion about all the different things that would have been laws had Christmas been a Jewish holiday. Christmas is not a Jewish holiday, and those are just jokes. Niche jokes, but jokes. The story of Jewish observances of Christmas really starts with the Mishnah, one of the earliest rabbinic texts, 3rd century of the Common Era. So there's a Mishnah in a tractate called Avodah Zarah. And this deals with, this is one of the earliest texts that deals with Jewish relations with Gentiles, specifically pagans, because that was the world. The world in the 3rd century, the Roman world, was still overwhelmingly pagan. So the Mishnah states, Lifnei Edei Hen, before their, it says Edei Hen, their holidays. Right? The word Ed actually goes back to the Bible. In Deuteronomy chapter 32, talks about Yom Edom, their holiday. You even have, it's cognate in modern Arabic. You talk about Eid al-Fitr, Eid al-Adha. So lifnei edehen, before these holidays, these pagan holidays, shel ovdei kuchavim, shlosha yom, for 3 days, asur v'lased v'latedi mahem, it's forbidden to transact with them, lahash ilan l'shol mehem, to borrow things from them, objects from them, and to lend them objects, lahalvotan v'lvot mehem, to borrow or lend money to them, l'foran u'l'froa mehem, to pay them back a loan or to be repaid a loan. Now these are because what you're giving them will enhance their holiday or it will cause them to thank their deity. And so for 3 days before their holidays, this was forbidden. Now, no longer live in a pagan world. Jews live in a world that's dominated by Christians and Muslims. Most Jews today live in Christian environments or among Muslims. So there has been, the laws as formulated there don't apply as they once did. However, there were times that they did, or there were places that they did, even in Christian and Muslim environments. And one of the classic commentaries on the Mishnah, Rabbeinu Ovadia Mibartanura, originally from Bertinoro, Italy. We're talking 16th century here, who traveled widely and ended up in the land of Israel, in Palestine, in the 16th century. And he's buried on Harazetim. And he wrote a classic commentary on the Mishnah. And his commentary on that Mishnah, he says, Asur laseit v'latet im notzrim b'chol yom rishon. It is forbidden to do business with Christians on any Sunday, any given Sunday. B'chein, b'chol yom eid shelahen, on any of their holidays, she'osin oso, that they make kigon netel upashqua. So, netel, nittel, and Pasqua, that's Christmas and Easter. Netel as in natal, as in birth, although there are other creative etymologies as to why Christmas got the name nittel, but this was an Italian-speaking Jew who writes that it's natal, the holiday of the birth, like natology or natality rate, right? That, the word nate, N-A-T-E, N-A-T-A-L, that Latin, that's the Latin root for birth. And Pasqua. English speakers are used to hearing about Easter, but in pretty much every other language spoken, in pretty much every other language, the word for Easter is some cognate of the Hebrew word Pascha, or the Aramaic word Pascha, which is the Hebrew word Pesach, because Easter happened, it celebrates an event that happened on Passover, on Pesach. So Rabbeinu Ovadia says that any Sunday, and on Christmas and on Easter, it's forbidden to do business with Christians. Aval shar yemei edam, but on all other holidays of theirs, she'osin l'shem hakidoshim shalahem, such as the holidays that they make for their saints. Right? And if you look at a Christian calendar, an older Christian calendar, pretty much every day is some sort of Saint's Day. We know of a few of them, right? Like St. Patrick's Day. But there's St. George's Day, and there's St. Nicholas's Day, and there's St. Sebastian's Day, and any day on the calendar. And when you have thousands of saints, you know, everybody gets their own day, and you're still going to have leftovers. So all the leftovers go, they're celebrated on All Saints' Day, right? Which is November 1st, and it's preceded by All Hallows' Eve, which is Halloween. So, but Rabbeinu Ovadia is saying that the All Saints' Day, or all the other days that are just for the saints. She'ain topsin b'hem shem elahut. The saints that are not considered deities, mutar. It is permissible to do business with them. It's only not permissible on days that are celebrated in honor of deities. And the mainstream Christian churches, the Orthodox churches, Catholic, Protestant, all consider Jesus a deity. And that, from a Jewish perspective, is what makes the day problematic. The fact that there are saints that are celebrated, that would not be as problematic from a Jewish perspective, and it wouldn't mean that there's a prohibition on doing business. So that's the first law of Christmas, but it's, you know, the first halacha of Christmas, but it's a derivative of a broader law. The broader law is formulated with regard to all non-Jewish holidays, foreign holidays, and specifically holidays of, you know, that belong to other religions. There's also a responsum from Maharam Rutenberg, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg. So this is a little bit earlier. This is, he died at the end of the 13th century. And he says, in the name of Rabbeinu Shmuel, that's Rabbi Samuel ben Meir, 12th century, who says in the name of his grandfather, Rabbeinu Shlomo, that's Rashi, 11th century, the Rashi that we all know and love, Demin Hadin, technically, Eino Asar Lischor, Ela Biyom Ha'ed She'osin Bishvil Yeshu HaNotzri. That technically, the only prohibition, the prohibition against doing business with Christians, is only on holidays that celebrate Jesus of Nazareth himself. Kigon, for example, Nittel v'kina. Nittel and kina. I don't know how kina became a word for Easter, but he's clearly referring to Easter, because Rabbeinu Ovadia is clearly referring back to this. So it's only Christian. It's only Christmas and Easter. Of Al Shar HLM, there are other holidays. Ein Tofsin Bo Mamashut. They're not as real. It's not as palpable. Fine. So we have, again, this is an application of an existing law to Christmas. But there are certain cases, there are certain customs that developed specifically around Christmas, meaning laws or customs that were not observed in general on non-Jewish holidays, but specifically on Christmas. So one is recorded in a gloss, meaning a marginal note, on a compilation of customs from the 15th century by Rabbi Isaac of Turnau, in today's Slovakia. And the gloss is, I'm not sure who wrote the gloss. I'm not sure if anybody knows who wrote the gloss. The gloss is the little marginal note, and that's what they used to do. You would have a manuscript, and you would update it based on local customs. And if the local custom was that this is what we do, then they would add it in the margins. So the main text says that we say the prayer of Aleinu at the end of the daily prayers. We say it out loud. Aleinu is a prayer that celebrates how privileged we are, how lucky we are, how fortunate we are to have been, to be able to praise God and to worship God. And there are lines in there, some have been censored out, some of them have been restored, that say that, you know, we worship the one true God, unlike those others, right, who worship Hevel Varik, right, emptiness and air. And so there's discussion, is that a specific reference? Whether it is or isn't, that's how it was taken to be. And so Elenu had a certain, there was a certain amount of pride, a certain amount of even, you know, that we're privileged to have this and you are not. Now, when Jews were minorities living in, you know, living in Christian Europe, this was an important reinforcement of their identity. And so in this custom, to say it out loud, the gloss says, well, we don't really say it out loud anymore, but Nahagu Beleil Nitl, the custom is that on Nitelnacht, the night of Natal, Christmas Eve, Lomar Aleinu B'kol Rum, to say the Aleinu prayer out loud. Af She'ein No'agin Bo B'chol Shana, B'chol HaShana, even though we don't do that the rest of the year. So that, I don't know if that's practiced anymore anywhere, but that's one such custom that developed specifically on Christmas. And then there's a cluster of sources, all from the late 17th through the 18th century, that talk about a specific custom of not studying Torah on Christmas Eve. Now, the first one, the first such source, is in a book called Makor Chaim. Makor Chaim is one of those tragic books of Jewish history. Not that it's about something tragic. It was written by Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach of the city of Worms in Germany. Now, Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach, he's best known for the responsa Chavot Yair, Chavos Yair. It's one of the classic works of responsa. And he himself was one of the leading rabbis of his generation. And he wrote this work, Makor Chaim, as a commentary on Shulchan Aruch, Orach Chaim. The Orach Chaim, the daily life section of the Shulchan Aruch, which had already at that point become the standard code of Jewish law. And he was going to take it to the printer. And as he got to Frankfurt, where he was going to print it, he saw that there was a new book on the shelf, and that new book was Orach Chaim of the Shulchan Aruch, the exact book that he had written the commentary on, with two brand new commentaries, one called Magen David, which was written by the Taz, by David Halevi, and the other one called Magen Avraham, written by Rav Avraham Gombiner. And these became two of the classic commentaries on that section of Shulchan Aruch. And he saw it, and he said, well, then there's no point in me. It's a flooded market. It's a crowded market, So he had other manuscripts, including manuscripts of his father's works that hadn't been published yet. So he published those with the money he had raised. And he took Makor Chaim back home, and he updated it. Like, he made new comments based on what he saw in Magen Avraham, but he never got a chance to publish it again, and it sat in manuscript. It's a phenomenal commentary, but that sat in manuscript for another 300 years, till it was finally published in the 1980s. Now, there are parts of it where we don't have the complete commentary. And sometimes he wrote himself little notes that, this is what I want to write about here, but we don't have the full commentary of what he wrote. So when he talks about, in the laws of Talmud Torah, when he talks about that it's required to learn, to study Torah every night, every day and every night, because of V'hagita bo yomam balayla, study it day and night, he cites, in his little cliff notes, in his little index for what he wants to write, he says, Minhag bitul halimud bilel chuga ploni. He wants to write about the minhag, not to learn on that holiday, on such and such a holiday. And it's clear that he's talking about Christmas. How do I know that he's talking about Christmas? Well, this one, I'm kind of proud of this because I haven't seen anybody else discuss this source. And the source has not been printed or published anywhere. It's a source called Yair Nativ. The same Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach has a manuscript where he indexed all of his writings. He wrote constantly. He wrote all kinds of stuff. And he would write sermons. He would write out if he had new ideas, novel ideas, if he responded to a halakha question, if he was learning something, he had a comment to make, he would write it all down. And at some point, he made an index of his own writings. Right? So he filled up, 30, 40 notebooks with all of his commentaries on everything. And then he made an index of all of these writings. And you can see in the index that he pulls the response that he published in Chavot Yair. You'll see he adds into this index, he says, I was asked about so-and-so, and I answered, and then you'll see next to it, this I published in Chavot Yair, Siman, right, section, whatever it is, 150, 250, whatever it is. And it's just a fascinating work. It's in manuscript. It's been digitized. It's at the National Library of Israel, and it's been digitized, so you can go online on the Ketiv website and actually see it and read it. And it's a really fascinating little work. So I found there one line where it's one line where he says, Rav Mefursam Amar, a famous rabbi said, Shelo Yerdu Nashim L'Taharatan B'Leil Nitzel, that women should not go to purify themselves, meaning they shouldn't go to the mikvah on Leil Nitzel. Now, that is a custom that, there are a few Hasidic groups that until recently or possibly even still today observe that custom. This is the earliest reference to that specific custom. And again, we're talking the late 1600s. And the question is, so we see that in the environment of Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach, in the environment of in Worms in the late 1600s, these customs of Nitel were known, were observed. The question is why? We don't really see why. And one possibility is, look, it was dangerous to go outside, especially a woman alone shouldn't go outside on Nitel Nacht because it's dangerous. So I'm not sure that's the answer because, first of all, he doesn't say that it's because of danger. He doesn't say why at all, but he says if it was danger, then it would be a question of common sense. It wouldn't be you don't have to quote, a famous rabbi as saying, don't go outside when it's dangerous. When it's dangerous, you don't go outside because that's just good common sense. You don't have to say, oh, Rabbi so-and-so should say that you shouldn't go out during a potential pogrom. Common sense. And the other thing is that in Worms in the late 1600s, the Jews, it wasn't an integrated city. The Jews lived in a Judengasse. They lived on a Jewish street, the mikveh, and it's interesting here, it says, Lo yerdu nashim l'taharatan. Women shouldn't go down to be mitaher. In several places in the Rhineland, you can find mikvaot, which are literally underground. They're very deep underground, including in Worms, where Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach was. Now, he's quoting a Rav Mefursam. We don't know exactly where this Rav Mefursam was, where this other rabbi was, but chances are, if they were in one of the larger communities there, Frankfurt was the same story, the Jews were sequestered in a particular neighborhood, and the mikveh was underground. So it's quite possible that it wouldn't have been that dangerous to go out in the Jewish quarter. The Jewish quarter would have been locked. Nobody would have been able to go in and out of the Jewish quarter, but within the Jewish quarter, there would have been relative safety. So in order to say that it's dangerous, I think we need more evidence. And as I will show, I think that there was another reason. The other reason is first mentioned by Karban Netanel. Carbonetanil. Now we're talking 18th century. He died in the middle of the 18th century. So his productive, you know, the time that he was active during the first half of the 18th century. He's most famous for writing a commentary on the Rush called Carbonetanil, which is standard in all printed editions of the Rush. And he, I don't know where the manuscript is, it's quoted by a book called Nitte Gavriel, which is the indispensable resource for all things Nittel. Six chapters of what Jews do on Nittel. Mostly later, mostly Hasidic customs, but this shiur is going to focus on pre-Hasidic customs. So he says, Ki Laila Zu, speaking of Nittel, Laila Zu Kimo Yom Shecharav Beit HaMikdash. This night is like the night that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed. Umitam Zeh, and for this reason, Asur Lilmod. It's forbidden to learn Kimo B'Tisha B'Av, like it's Tisha B'Av. It's a day of mourning. It's a night of mourning. Umitam Zeh, Asur Ligalot. But it's forbidden to reveal this reason, meaning we don't want to tell the Christians that we are in mourning on the day that their Savior was born. Mikoach zeh, nishtarvev haminhag hara shesochakim. But because we don't tell anybody any reasons, and because we just say, don't learn Torah on this night, it's spread that what do people do instead? They play. They play. They have fun on Nittelnacht. And this same idea of that it's about mourning, like mourning the destruction of the temple, first of all, that would explain why there's no Torah study and why women wouldn't go to the mikvah, because they wouldn't go to the mikvah on Tisha B'Av night either. And in addition to that, we have two other reports of, you know, that this is the reason. Chatam Sofer, who his life spanned the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th centuries, almost evenly. He was born in 1762. He died in 1839, and he was born in Frankfurt. And his main rebbe, his main teacher, was Rabbi Natan Adler, who was a Kabbalist who was living there and who had an interesting relationship with the community, because on one hand they realized that he was an absolute first-rate Talmid Chacham Gadol, a first-rate Talmudic mind and Jewish mind in general. On the other hand, he did his own thing and he did things his way. He was very idiosyncratic, which, you know, that gave trouble to the establishment. So several times they tried excommunicating him, and it didn't work because, you know, he was clearly, you know, he outclassed them. But so they tried to rein him in other ways with varying degrees of success. But he, you know, part of his legacy is that he was the Rebbe of the Chatam Sofer, as well as other major, well-known rabbinic figures of the day. So Chatam Sofer says in the name of his Rebbe, Rav Natan Adler, and he also says in the name of his own father, Chatam Sofer, he was from a rabbinic family. His great-grandfather was Rav Shmuel Shaten, the Mahar Shashach, who was a Rav in Frankfurt in the early 18th century. He had pedigree. So when he says that his own father and Rav Natan Adler both had this custom of not studying on the night of Christmas Eve, and as observing it as a night of fasting, So we now have a cluster of four sources. So let's imagine the Chatam Sofer left his hometown of Frankfurt when he was a teenager. He left with Rav Nathan Adler at one of the points when Rav Nathan Adler was banished. And he never returned to his hometown from the age of something like 16. So when he's 16, that's the late 1770s. That's about 100 years after Rav Yair Chaim Bachrach is recording Yair Nativ and is writing Makor Chaim. So you have, in that century, four sources that all talk about a custom not to learn Torah on Christmas Eve. Three of them give a reason. Rabbi Natan Elweil, who I neglected to mention, he was in Karlsruhe, which is also a German city in the Upper Rhine region. He's saying that it's because of mourning. And the Chatam Sofer's father and teacher, his father and Rav Nathan Adler, are all saying that it's because of mourning. It's the observance of a mourning custom. And the Chavot Yair himself, who's not saying that he doesn't say explicitly that it's because of mourning, but he does record two customs. Number one, not to study Torah. And number two, that women shouldn't go to the mikvah. And the explanation that it's a mourning custom would account for both of those customs. And all four of these sources are in the same region. Right? Two in Frankfurt, one in the city of Worms, which is just a little bit further up the Rhine, and another one in Karlsruhe, which is also just a little bit further up the Rhine. So you have within this very specific area four sources that talk about, or four reports or statements that say that we don't study Torah on Christmas Eve for a specific reason, that it's a mourning custom. So it seems very, very likely that the origin of this custom, we have more or less, we have a time, and more or less, we have a place, right? It's in the Upper Rhineland at some point in the 17th century is when this custom of not studying Torah on Nittel emerges. The Chatam Sofer himself gave an entirely different reason for why we don't study Torah on Nittel. Chasam Sofer. Now, Chasam Sofer has a certain reputation as being the Mr. Chadash Asar Min HaTorah. Oh, nothing new is allowed. Which is a funny thing, because he was one of the most brilliant and innovative thinkers that Judaism has ever known. And it's one of those things that, like, when you say that nothing new is permitted, then you can get away with doing a whole lot of new things, right? There's a certain give and take there. There's a certain artfulness in creating something new but saying that it's old. That it has to be artful. It has to have credibility. So here, he's not, the implications of what he's doing are entirely new. But he's doing it as though he's preserving a custom and even recovering its original meaning. So he quotes his father and Rav Nathan Adler as saying that there is a custom not to study Torah on Nittelnacht. But then he asks questions on that. He says, first of all, and now he gives us a new bit of information about this custom, which we didn't see before in... We didn't see this in Chavot Yair. We didn't see this in the Karban Netanel. Says that the custom was only to refrain from studying Torah until midnight. So he says, when it comes to Avelut, when it comes to not you know, when it comes to the customs of mourning, we don't split up a night. He says, when do we ever have a situation where you split up a night? He says, my chiluk bein kodem chatzot l'laila l'acharav. What's the difference between before midnight and after midnight? Shenagu heter l'achar chatzot, because the minhag, the custom is that it's permitted to study Torah after midnight. What's the basis for that distinction? V'heichon matzina depligi rabbanan b'takanta didhu bein palga d'laila. Where do we ever find that the rabbis, you know, in an enactment, divide the night in half? The truth of the matter is, there are places where the rabbis divide the night in half. For example, the first Mishnah talks about that you shouldn't eat from the Paschal sacrifice beyond midnight, or that you shouldn't daven Ma'ariv, pray the evening services, after midnight. But be that as it may, it's still bizarre that the rabbis would say you're not allowed to learn half the night. Ve'od, and he asks further, the Chatam Sofer does, the Havalei Lahatir Perek Elu Megalchin V'Sefer Iyov. There are certain corpora of Torah that can be read, that can be studied on Tisha B'Av, or by a mourner. For example, the chapter called Elu Megalchin, which is the third chapter of Tractate Moed Katan, Maseches Moed Katan, which deals with the laws of mourning. So it's permitted to study the laws of mourning when you're a mourner. Or the Book of Job, which is a very philosophical and sad book. It's permitted for a mourner to study those. And there are other things that a mourner is permitted to study. The sections of the Talmud that deal with the destruction of the temple and other things. But on Nitelnacht, it was a blanket. Nobody's allowed to study anything. No Torah study on Nitelnacht. By the way, you might think this is a bizarre custom, but if you look around, most of the Jewish world today studies this. You know, observes this custom. Most Jews do not study Torah on Christmas Eve. This is not unique to Christmas Eve. They don't study Torah on any night. What's Christmas? You say, on this night, you know, on Tisha B'Av and on Nitelnacht, all Jews are united and are not studying Torah. But what's the reason, according to the Chatam Sofer? He says, to Efshar, it's possible, right? He's saying this is a... It's possible, it's a suggestion, which means he knows he's saying something that's novel. Shenagu kadmonenu kemi shum shalolitin makom lebaal din lachlok lesatin lekatreg but biyos baoso lila kola amim noadim lebeisalo ehem mechatzos ve'elach kayadua. Ve'am Hashem elu yeshenim almito sehem afilu lomde Torah rubam kecholam naorim tchilas alayla v'yeshenim achar chatzos. So he says, what would it be if it was permissible to study Torah in the first half of the night? So the students of Torah, the people who are serious about it, they would stay up at night, like they normally do, studying Torah. Because normally they would stay, that's what they would do. They would stay up late, right? This is after the introduction of coffee. Before the introduction of coffee, you would get up early and study Torah. After the introduction of coffee, you would stay up late and study Torah. So what's going to be? So we know that the main observance is at midnight, right? Midnight Mass. So at midnight, all of the Christians are going to be in church praising their deity, and all the Jews are going to be in bed sleeping. Even the greatest scholars among the Jews are going to be getting their beauty rest. How would that look up in heaven? It would look like it would give an opening for kitruk, for accusations to be leveled against us. Look at your Jews. They're sleeping in their beds while the Christians are in their churches worshiping. But what should the rabbis have done? They should have made an enactment saying that, okay, the Jews also have to get up at midnight and study Torah. But that also wouldn't have looked good. That would have been like, first of all, it would have been much more confrontational, saying, oh, you should get up at midnight in order to study Torah, because that's when the Catholics are going to Mass. That would have been, that wouldn't have looked good either. So what do? Say, you're not allowed to study Torah the first half of the night. You're not allowed to study Torah the first half of the night. If you say you're not allowed to study Torah in the first half of the night, what are the people that are serious about Torah study going to do? They'll go to sleep the first half of the night. And in the winter in Germany, it gets dark really early. You can get a good night's sleep before midnight. You wake up at midnight. You start studying Torah when midnight Mass starts. And that way, you don't have to directly make an enactment against, you know, corresponding to midnight Mass, corresponding to what they do, to what the Christians do. But at the same time, you neutralize this accusation against the Jews by saying, nope, the Jews are up, the Jews are studying Torah. It reminds me of something that happened with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who I was privileged to study with for a few years. On Tisha B'Av, when it's prohibited to study Torah, it's also prohibited to eat. So after the fast ends, people go and they break their fast. They haven't eaten in 25 hours. There was one year when he was younger and strong, after Ma'ariv, after the evening services concluded, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein went back into the study hall, into the Beit Midrash, and he opened up a sefer. He started studying Torah. And somebody said to him, like, aren't you hungry? And he says, well, we've been deprived of several things over the past day. And apparently, for some people it was harder to be without food. For Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, it was harder to be without Torah for 25 hours than it was to be without food for 25 hours. So these are the types of people that the Chasam Sofer is describing here. Right? You tell them that you're not allowed to study Torah for this first half of the night. That means that they're going to get up at midnight because they miss it. They can't live without it. So they're going to get up at midnight and they're going to start studying Torah. And that's who's going to be there, and that's who you want to be there. The last source that we're going to look at, and this is the last source that we'll call pre-Hasidic. Right? Once we get to the early decades of the 1800s, the sources that discuss Nittelnacht are almost exclusively Hasidic sources, to the extent that it became understood as a Hasidic minhag. And today, if you ask, who doesn't study Torah on Nittelnacht? They'll say it's Hasidim. Right? And there are discussions, so what did they do instead? So there's lots of famous and cute stories. There was one Hasidic Rebbe who, he would tear toilet paper. What does that mean? So there are, the question of tearing toilet paper on Shabbat, it's a question. There are some that are careful not to tear toilet paper on Shabbat, which means that you need a stash of toilet paper to last you the whole year. So this one Rebbe, he would go and he would just tear toilet paper all night so that he would have enough toilet paper for all of for all year. There are others, they say that they would play chess. And I think that that's part of we want to show that we're very sophisticated, we're intellectual. If we weren't studying Torah, we would be doing things like playing chess. So on this night that we're not allowed to study Torah, we're going to play chess. And there's a story that it came midnight, and the Rebbe, he banged on the table and said, okay, it's midnight, the chess game is over, and we're going to study Torah now. Which, I don't know if that means that the Rebbe was losing in his chess game and that the banging on the table actually messed up the board so that he wouldn't lose the game, but whatever it is. And I also, I once, and this is a true story, I'm not making this up, I have several friends who are Chabad Shluchim, I have several friends who are Chabad shluchim, and I once asked, by the way, Chabad in Russia, they kept the Russian Orthodox Christmas, which does not account for the Gregorian shift, and therefore it takes place 12, 13 days, it's a week or a week to 10 days into January, I'm not exactly sure, January 8th, January 9th. They didn't study Torah on the Russian Orthodox Christmas because that was the environment that they lived in. In Catholic countries, they accounted for the Gregorian shift, or in Protestant countries, they accounted for the Gregorian shift. There were some that lived in countries that were mixed, right? Romania is mixed, Hungary is mixed, Ukraine is mixed. So places like that, people were very, very careful and didn't study Torah on either night. There are such reports. So I asked my friend, the Chabad Shliach, what did they do in yeshiva when he was studying in yeshiva? What did they do on Nitelnacht? Did they study? Did they learn Torah? Did they not? And he thinks for a second and he says, oh, we played Risk. And I, you know, that just spawned, you know, this whole imaginative line of thinking. So first of all, I'm thinking, of course you played Risk. It's about conquering the world. What else would they be playing in Chabad? You know, world domination. You know, you go to, today, all these places that we mentioned, Frankfurt, who runs the show in Frankfurt? Chabad. Pressburg, which is where the Chasam Sofer was. Who runs the show in Pressburg? Who's the one Orthodox rabbi there? Chabad. The next source we're going to talk about is from Prague. Who runs the show in Prague? Well, a lot of people, but the most vibrant community is probably Chabad. So all of these places, which were all from other traditions, today they're Chabad. So I guess playing Risk was the appropriate thing to do. And it also got me wondering if that's how they figure out, like, where they're supposed to go for Shlichus, right? Meaning, do they have, like, a deck of Risk cards? And when it comes time to know where you're going to be sent as an emissary, that you pick a card from the deck, and when you look at the card, that tells you where you're supposed to go, and it's like, ah, oh, I got Kamchatka. I wonder. I don't think that's how it works. But it was, to me, I thought it was kind of interesting that they played Risk. So, back to our final source. This source was discovered recently in an archive at the Charles University in Prague by Professor Mark Shapiro. It was an interesting, very, very knowledgeable, wide-ranging knowledge Jewish studies professor at the University of Scranton. And he found this correspondence between two men who lived in Prague in the beginning of the 1800s. One was Rev Elazar Fleckelis. Rev Elazar Fleckelis was not officially the chief rabbi of Prague, but he was unofficially the chief rabbi of Prague. There were others. He was a student of the Noda Yehuda. He was a student of Rev Yecheskel Landau, who was one of the great poskim and gaonim of the previous generation. He died in the late 1700s, and very, very influential posek. So Rav Elazar Fleckelis was his primary student. Now, in Prague at the time, you had other primary students, including the Noda Yehuda's son, which is probably why Rav Elazar Fleckelis was not named the official chief rabbi. But he was recognized as a leading pupil. And he himself wrote a work of responsa called Teshuva Me Ahava, which itself is a very interesting work. And itself has a responsum that Rav Elazar Fleckelis wrote to this same person that he wrote, you know, that received this correspondence from him, who was a man named Carl Fischer, not related to me. I know he's not related to me because this Carl Fischer was not Jewish. This Carl Fischer had an interesting job. His job was to be the censor of the Jewish books. The censor of Jewish books for the government of Bohemia, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time. He was the censor, and he had held that job for something like 50 years. He lived in Prague, and you can see books that were printed in Prague around this time. They all have his stamp in it where it says that this has been confirmed, this has been reviewed by and confirmed for publication by Carolus Fischer, Carl Fischer, the royal censor. They had a very interesting relationship, which perhaps we'll get to it at some point. Maybe we'll discuss this other responsum another time. This other responsum between Fischer and Revolazar Fleckelis, which had to do with taking oaths in civil courts, and using a chumash with the status of an oath that a Jew takes on a chumash in Gentile courts. That's the other responsum. There are very few responsum at all that are written in Hebrew to non-Jews. This is one of them. And the subject of this correspondence, which wasn't published anywhere until Mark Shapiro discovered it and published it in an article, was Nittelnacht, was the custom of not studying Torah on Christmas Eve. And the nature of the relationship between Rav Fleckelis and Carl Fischer comes out a little bit in this responsum. It's dated to the summer of 1812. These two men have known each other for a long time by then, and it was written to Rav Fleckelis while he was vacationing in Teplitz, which was a resort town not far from Prague. It would be interesting. A lot of responses were written from resort towns. It would be interesting. There's a project that I have about mapping responsa. Maybe one day we'll do a responsa mapping out all of the different resorts where rabbis used to vacation, that, and we know that they were there at a certain point because they wrote responsa from there. So Carl Fischer asks him, so after the standard greetings, yesterday I was asked, right? So this is your classic, I'm asking for a friend. Yesterday someone asked me, Lahodiadati im emet, for my opinion, if it's true, Shayehudim b'leil arucha hanikra nitel o nitel, that the Jews, who on this night that they call nitel, nitel o nitel means spelled two different ways, with a tet, which is how we saw it in all the other sources that I brought, it's with a tet or with a taf, nital, which shows a certain, it means hanged, right? As though, I think this is an inversion that, like, we've said that there were some creative etymologies. This nital with a taf is that, yes, it's because, you know, he was hanged or crucified, although that wouldn't make sense because that would be more for Easter than for Christmas, which was the day of his birth, but moving on. So is it true that Jews on this night, einam oskim b'Torah, they don't study Torah, kim matzchikim, they joke around, umesachkin, and they play games, va'ochlin shum barav, and they eat a lot of garlic, right? Jews and garlic, there was this old trope, Jews eat a lot of garlic. Kedosh lo tiye menucha l'oto rasha. Now we see another reason why Jews didn't learn on Nittel, so that there's no rest for that wicked person. Okay? Which wicked person? We'll see. Im minagahu yusad bedat v'din Torat Moshe, o bedat v'din Torah Sheba Alpeh, o betikunei rabbanim. Right, so Carl Fischer, he knows his stuff. He's like, is this a law of the Torah? Or is this a law of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law? Or is it an enactment of the rabbis, right? He knows the differences between these things because it's part of his job, and also he liked it, as we're going to about to see. Next question, Umi oto rasha asher nidon begihino. And who is the rasha? Who is that wicked person in hell that by joking around, they don't, you know, they're not giving any rest, any menucha to that Russia? Who exactly, which Russia are they talking about? The Lama Nikra Nittel. Why is it called Nittel?
Gamni Shalti, I was also asked, and here Carl Fischer is sort of, he's showing his hand a little bit more. I was also asked, am I ohev HaYehudi? He was accused of being a philo-Semite. Is it true that I like the Jews? Or, even worse, am I an advocate of the Jews? Am I a Jewish advocate? Am I some sort of plant, a Gentile planted by the Jews to advocate on their behalf within Christian society? This is what I'm accused of. Amarti, that question I could answer, says Carl Fischer. I said, Kol mi shemidaber emet, anyone who speaks the truth, v'holech v'derech yesharim, and walks the path of the upright, yiyeh Yehudi, be that person a Jew, o Mary, mem, ayin, resh, yud, be that person a Jew or a Mary. What is a Mary? A Mary is a Moor. This was the standard German and Yiddish term for a black person. Be that person Jewish, or black, o Yevani, or Greek, o Yishmaeli, or an Ishmaelite, or a Muslim, hu chashuv v'ra'uy la'ahava. That person is important and worthy of love. So his answer is subtle. It says, I don't love the Jews specifically. I love any person who speaks the truth and walks in the path of the upright. And so he's saying to Elazar Fleckless, to Rav Elazar Fleckless, my love for the Jews, my love for you, is contingent on a certain amount of truth-telling. So tell the truth here. Be honest. And here is what Rav Elazar Fleckless responds. And Rav Elazar Fleckless is, I would say he's being somewhat diplomatic here. Rav Elazar Fleckless probably knew of this custom, and he probably knew the various reasons for the custom. As we saw in the Karban Netanel, if the reason is avelut, if the reason is that we are in mourning as though it's the destruction of the temple, it wouldn't do to reveal that, and he says that we shouldn't reveal it. It wouldn't do to reveal that. So what is Rav Elazar Fleckless to do? So he says, Etzli Yesod HaMusad. For me, the foundation, the solid foundation is Kol Davar She'eno Muva B'Talmud Gadol B'Rif B'Rambam B'Harash V'Hatur Lo Ashiv Aleihem Davar V'Chatzi Davar. So first of all, Rav Elazar Fleckless, as I mentioned, is a student of the Nodeb Yehuda. The Nodeb Yehuda, part of his project that wasn't shared, for example, by the Chasam Sofer, but part of his project was a purification process, to banish from halachic discourse anything that wasn't based in Shas Uposkin, anything that wasn't from the Talmud or from the classic commentaries on the Talmud. So Rav Elazar Fleckless, who's a student, a primary student of the Nodeb Yehuda, says, for me, only the things that are in Shas and Poskim, that are in the Talmud and the Rambam and the Rif and the Rush and the Torah, that's all I can talk about. Everything else is outside the realm of halachic discourse. So, again, he's speaking personally, and he's saying, this is how it should be. Whether or not people actually do that, I don't know, but this is how it should be. Ki hamonam lo binot mikolam, because our masses, they're no smarter than any other nation. Amtsinu ma'aminim ma shelibam chafetz. If there are other Jews who are superstitious, well, I can't help that. There may be superstitions out there, but I can't help that. For me, it's Shas and Poskim. Shas and Poskim say nothing about this. V'hine lo nimtza b'svarim hanizkarim shekaru leil arucha b'shem nitl. In these books, it's not called nitl. U'mashin ish'al adoni yedidi yechia. Im emetra yudim ochlim b'shotim u'misachkim b'leil zeh. What about the fact that Jews they eat and they drink and they play and they joke on this night. Is that true? And he says, yup, it's true. Emes v'yatzir v'nachon. Kama Yehudim socharim yoshrim agudot agudot besod mischakim umarbim besuda. There are many Jewish merchants. There are several Jewish merchants who sit in groups and they play games and they eat a ton. But guess what? Olel zebil vat. It's not just this night. Kiim b'chol hachagim u'b'chol yom rishon b'chol shana. It's every holiday and every New Year's Day. Meaning, what's the issue here? Why is it that they're not, that they're eating and they're drinking and they're playing games on this night? Well, because they got off tomorrow. Because all the Christians aren't going to be going to work. So they're merchants. They work for a living. They don't have work the next day because nobody else is, the markets aren't open. So what do? They stay up all night hanging out, playing, doing, you know, they go to eat Chinese food, they go to the movies. That's what they do on Christmas. Because they don't have work the next day. Because they don't have business. They don't have work the next day. And then he says, Umasha katav she'enam oskim b'torah b'leil arukah. Is there a special minhag not to learn Torah? It's like, well, those guys, again, I can't answer for those guys. But me'id ani elai shamayim va'aretz, with heaven and earth as my witness, ani v'rabotai, me and my teachers, v'chaverai and my peers, v'talmidai and my students, lamadnu me'olam b'leil zeh k'shar leilot. We learned on this night like on any other night. Now, does that mean that we learned on this night like we learned on every other night? Meaning, in which case, he's obfuscating a little bit, that we got up at midnight to learn because that was the custom. Or is he saying, no, we learned on this night like we learned on the same way that we learn on every other night? Meaning, at night, we opened up our books and we sat and we studied. And I think it's the latter, because if you see the next line, paraphrasing the Haggadah, Manishtana Halayla Ezemikol Halayla. Why should this night be different than any other night? Anachnu Bnei Yisrael, Nitztavenu, V'Hagita Bo Yomam V'Layla. We, the people of Israel, have been commanded. Study it day and night. So that's what we did. And that's what we do. Me and my students and my peers and my teachers, that's what we do because that's what we've always done. And then his last, he signs off. Oh, and by the way, me'achilat shum, that garlic thing. I don't know what that's about. So here, again, we see we're going to end because this is the pre-Hasidic history of observance of Nittel. Was Rav Elazar Fleckelis aware of these customs or not? Almost positive that he would have been aware of them. How does he deal with them? He says they're superstition, and he takes the line of his Rebbe, the Noda Yehuda, that things that are of superstitious origin, those things have no place in halachic discourse, and we banish them. And therefore, me and our little circle here, we do study Torah. If there are people that don't, well, then I can't answer. Well, this is the true, this is the pure, correct Judaism. If there are other people that do something else, well, I can't answer for them. Yes, they're superstitious, and they believe in strange things, just like the masses of every religion in every nation has these superstitious beliefs. But if you want to know what the Torah says and what the truth that I, you know, that I practice, yes, we study Torah on Nittel Nacht like we study on any other night. So we see that it's interesting to contrast both the Chatam Sofer and Rav Elazar Fleckelis, who were contemporaries. They both had certain reservations about the prior custom, about the existing custom. Chatam Sofer found a way to preserve it while I don't know if you would say rationalize it, because the idea of Kitrug, that, you know, in heaven they're going to be saying, oh, this is what's going on, that the Jews are sleeping and the Christians are in church, you know, that's going to be a Kitrug, that somehow is going to be have a detrimental effect on the Jewish people, is, I wouldn't exactly call it a, you know, we wouldn't call that rational, although that's not what's rational and what's not is not exactly is not exactly constant, but it's something that he reinterprets it, understands it in a different way to neutralize it, to make it that we're not observing some kind of Tisha B'Av. It's not necessarily anti-Christian in the view of Chatam Sofer. It's just that it doesn't look good for the Jews if they're in church and they're praying and they're worshiping and we're in our beds. And Rav Elazar Fleckless, he neutralizes it in a different way, in a way that sort of dispenses and gets rid of the custom altogether, saying that it was a custom of the superstitious, and the true Torah way, the true pure way of Shas and Poskim, the way of the Noda Yehuda, is the way that I adhere to. So, on that note, a Merry Christmas to all.